Mr. Heck, thank you for appearing on the Casey Kohar Show, a celebration of words today.
Thank you very much. It's a pleasure.
We're at the University of the South, which is a beautiful university, and yesterday you were honored by the Sewanee Writers Conference in the University of the South. There was a celebration of your life and your work. And if you would, just tell me a bit about the University of the South and the Sewanee Writers Conference, what it's meant to you. I know Alan Tate was a colleague of yours.
Alan Tate was a teacher of mine, actually, and I studied with him when he was teaching at New York University. Before that, we had met at the Kenyon School of English, and he had been an editor of the Sewanee Review. And in the latter part of his life, I came on a reading tour of Tennessee, and I visited him at his home, which was right behind the Sewanee Inn, just adjacent to the golf course there. And he was a man I greatly revered and from whom I learned a lot and who was exceedingly kind and generous to me in many ways. And that, in fact, was my first visit to this region. And after that, I became acquainted with a great number of people who were here and who still are here. George Corr, for example, the present editor of the Sewanee Review, and Wyatt Prundy, who runs the Writers' Conference every summer. And the place has been exceedingly hospitable to me, so I'm grateful and delighted to find myself back.
Wonderful. One of my goals with the show is to give a voice to poetry, because I can remember in 1984 I heard you read your poetry here, and poetry came alive for me when I heard it read aloud by the poet who had written it. And I had an appreciation of poetry prior to that, but listening to you read your poems was a revelation. So if you would be so kind, I'd like you to read the new poem you have, which is, I believe, not published yet.
That's right, it's not yet published. It's called Motes and was written earlier this summer. They wandered out of gloom into some golden shaft of late afternoon light. Those tiny filaments that filled me with delight, lifted by an updraft or viewless influence there in the living room. They might be minuscule angels, it seemed to me, needing no wings to rise or slide back out of sight, but floating effortlessly through our interior skies, each incandescent mite a pilot at flight school. Their rises, their declines resembled Jacob's dream and seemed an allegory enacted just for me there in my own sunbeam, but swathed in mystery, some esoteric story wrought in encoded signs. One of them, one more of the shrewd, well-tried ways that a child is kept from some shrouded, grown-up truth, probably linked with tears. For the one thing clear to youth is that no joy goes unwept, and that their utmost fears will be amply justified, which makes them minor sages, without the words for what they cannot yet know or say, that whatever lies in store, they were typecast in some play with a far from comic plot, grief, selfishness, and war crowding its dog-eared pages.
Thank you. Last night when you read the poem aloud, I saw the audience was visually moved by that particular poem. And I think that when I read your interview with Philip Poy, which is published from Between the Lines Press, that part of this was your childhood and your relationship with your father. And I understand he was a very up and down sort of man financially and emotionally, as was my father. Mm-hmm. And I think that in that poem you seem to capture that spirit. And I read a line recently that a friend, Mike Young, told me about, and the statement was that all parents damage their children. And I'd like your reaction to, just a brief reaction to that, and perhaps where that poem...
It's a very hard topic to address, because one is not only, of course, at some point a child, but I have now grown to be a parent. And I guess I would have to acknowledge that in some ways my son, I have three of them, but I'm thinking of the youngest of them, has suffered to a certain extent by omissions of things that I might have done or commissions of things that I actually did. There's no way that a parent or a child, I think, can gauge that. We are the victims of our parents, but we're also the beneficiaries of them. And it's very hard to sort out what is good and what is negative. I find it a very mysterious business altogether.
Indeed. Thank you. Please stay tuned to the Casey Kohar Show. We'll be right back after a break. Welcome back to the Casey Kohar Show, a celebration of words. We're joined today by Anthony Hecht, the prize-winning poet. And we're now going to hear Mr. Hecht read his poem, The Book of Jullich.
This poem has an epigraph in German that reads, Wir haben ein Gesetz, und nach dem Gesetz soll sterben, which is Martin Luther's translation of the Gospel of John, chapter 19, verse 9. We have a law, and by that law he must die. The doused coals fume and hiss after your meal of grilled brook trout, and you saunter off for a walk down the fern trail. It doesn't matter where to, just so you're weeks and worlds away from home, among midsummer hills, have set up camp in the deep bronze glories of declining day. You remember peacefully an earlier day in childhood, remember a quite specific meal, a corn roast and bonfire in summer camp. That summer you got lost on a nature walk. More than you dared admit, you thought of home. No one else knows where the mind wanders to. The 5th of August, 1942. It was morning and very hot. It was the day they came with rifles to the home for Jewish children, cutting short the meal of bread and soup, lining them up to walk in close formation off to a special camp. How often you have thought about that camp, as though in some strange way you were driven to, and about the children, and how they were made to walk. Jolek, who had bad lungs, who wasn't a day over 5 years old, commanded to leave his meal and shamble between armed guards to his long home. We're approaching August again. It will drive home the regulation torments of that camp Jolek was sent to, his small unfinished meal, the electric fences, the numeral tattoo, the quite extraordinary heat of the day they all were forced to take that terrible walk. Whether on a silent, solitary walk or among crowds, far off or safe at home, you will remember helplessly that day and the smell of smoke and the loudspeakers of the camp. Wherever you are, Jolek will be there too. His unuttered name will interrupt your meal. Prepare to receive him in your home someday. Though they killed him in the camp they sent him to, he will walk in as you're sitting down to a meal.
Thank you. That poem is available in the new publication from Knopf titled Anthony Hecht, Collected Later Poems. There's also a book, Melodies Unheard, published by Johns Hopkins Press, which is also currently available. And I'd like to ask you, Mr. Hecht, about a quote from the conversation with Philip Hoy that I found interesting. The quote is, Joyce said it took him 20 years to write Finnegan's Wake, and he expected readers to take just as long to read it. The defiance is also probably a reaction to the public comparative indifference to poetry in general, a forlorn resignation to a minority readership. The more elite, the better, since there's not much choice in the matter. There's nothing wrong with inviting a reader to look up a word, unquote. My father was, one of the gifts he gave me was a dictionary. And if I did not know how to spell a word, he had me look the word up in the dictionary, read the definitions, and then use it in a sentence. And the beauty and the power of a word seems to me to be diluted when you have such ready access to dictionaries on the internet and a general laziness on people to stop and look up a word. And I'd just like to know what your thoughts on the word.
That's a very large topic. I'm afraid I don't know how to address it. But to go back to the original quotation that you gave in the interview with Philip Hoy, I think it began by his remarking that I use a certain extravagant vocabulary, large, recondite words and stuff of that sort, and whether I expected my readers instantly to recognize and know the meaning of all of them. And I answered, no, I didn't, that people could resort to a dictionary, if it came to that, and look up words. And indeed, they had to do this with a lot of literature from, the Elizabethan period, where terms have become obsolete. We don't use those words anymore. And in order to find out what Shakespeare meant, you simply had to resort to a dictionary or the kindly notes of an editor. And I didn't see that this was an unnecessary or trivial demand. And if people were willing to do it for Shakespeare, I thought they could do it for me, too. I don't try to make my poems extremely difficult by making them arcane, but every once in a while I find that there's a nice ringing word that's not widely known that I can make some use of. And I find that many, many modern poets, T.S. Eliot, Ezra Pound, W.H. Auden, John Crow Ransom, have all employed, and Thomas Hardy, unfamiliar words with great effect. And I, myself, of course, I'm not in the least troubled about going to the dictionary to look them up. I'm happy to do so.
Thank you. Please stay tuned to the Casey Kowar Show, a celebration of words. We'll be right back. Welcome back. My guest today is Anthony Hecht, the poet. He's been generous enough to read two of his poems so far. And one of the things that I find helpful in your poetry is occasionally you'll introduce a poem prior to reading it. And I find that very helpful. And I'm wondering, at what point do you trust the reader to be able to interpret the poem, or you think that maybe a brief introduction will be helpful to the message that you're conveying with the poem?
This is a complicated matter. When I give a poetry reading and nobody has before them the text of the poem itself except me, I know that the audience will have no opportunity to go to a dictionary and look up words. So I have to supply anything that might be a barrier of that sort. And sometimes I have to provide a context in which to describe what this poem intends and who is speaking and other contextual problems that would have been easily understood if one had a book before one. So I have to take into account the handicaps that a listener labors under.
Thank you. One of the poems that you read last night and that I found particularly moving, which I did not ask you to bring because I was going to ask you if you would to read the excerpt from the from your collected later poems. And if you would just read that brief
this
verse. Yes, I find it lovely.
Let me explain that this is the last stanza of a rather long poem addressed to my wife. Oh, my most dear, I know the live imprint of that smile of gratitude, know it more perfectly than any book. It brims upon the world a mood of love, a mode of gladness without stint. Oh, that I may be worthy of that look.
Thank you. When I read that, I was thinking that my wife, Tina Rich, I understood exactly what you were saying, and I've told her before, the fact that you love me is perhaps the greatest gift I've been given, and to truly feel that love from a woman.
Yes.
And I believe it is a gift and something that if one has that, life is infinitely more delightful. And if you would, tell me briefly about your wife and the ways that she has enriched your life.
Oh, that is, again, another one of those topics that's inexhaustible. But briefly, I taught at Smith College in Massachusetts from 1956 to 59, and during that period I was married in a very troubled marriage. And I had among the students in my class one who was wonderful, a very fine student. But that was all that she was to me then. Then many years later, I went off, my marriage dissolved, and then time went on, and I went to the National Book Awards when Mona Van Dyne was being given that award in Lincoln Center. And there was great reception at the end of the, after the program. And as I was making my way out, I saw this ravishing creature who had been my student at Smith many years before. And I said to her, "I know you, don't I?" And she said, "Oh yes, Mr. Hecht, you were my freshman English teacher." And so I got a date with her about a week later. And it took a while because she was heavily booked. But then after our first date, I scheduled another one. And on the third date, I proposed marriage, and she accepted. We waited, for our parents' sake, to marry for several months, so there was an interval. But from then on, life had been just wonderful. She was the managing editor of a publishing house when I met her this later time, when she was at the National Book Awards. And then from publishing, she went on, when we were married, to write cookbooks. She wrote five of them. And she did this principally because, A, there were no good restaurants in Rochester where we lived, and B, she wanted to be able to find some occupation that would allow her to spend as much time with our son as possible so she could stay at home with him and do this kind of work. And finally, she enjoyed cooking, and she made me very happy with the work she did at that. And then after her career as a cookbook writer, she became an interior designer, which she still does.
Wonderful. Thank you very much. Please stay tuned to the Casey Coar Show, A Celebration of Words, and we will return with a final poem from Anthony Hecht in just one moment. Welcome back to the Casey Coar Show, A Celebration of Words. Today's show we are going to end with a final reading by Anthony Hecht, who has most graciously been our guest today. Part of the goal of this show is to introduce the listener to poets reading their poetry. And there will not be a finer example that you will hear than Mr. Hecht. What he's going to read now is a poem called Death, the Film Director, from his collected later poems. And he's going to tell us a little bit about the series, and then he's going to read the poem. And with that, the show will conclude. Mr. Heck?
There is a series of poems that I wrote for this book called The Presumptions of Death, in which death becomes certain people in certain professions. He's in one poem, he's a judge, in another he's an Oxford don, then a Mexican revolutionary and a society matron. He can be either male or female, anything he wishes. And in this one that I want to read now, he is a film director. Open with a long shot, chimneys and spires of the old town rouged in the copper glow of sunset. Intense arterial red dyeing the trees as day slowly expires, staining the churches, pathways, fence posts, spread from roof to roof, while rising from below, cool tides of shadow lap the countryside, engulf the cemetery headstones, shroud arbor, tool shed, curbstone, and portico. Now, from behind a lazily drifting cloud, a full Pierrot white moon. Its bleaching light drains the lifeblood of everything in sight. Zoom down to a derelict alley, a scrawny cat sniffing through toppled garbage, till it finds a male, black-skinned, mature, immobile hand, its parent limb, head, body, all concealed by liquor cartons, broken Venetian blinds, worn tires, an unraveled welcome mat. The creature paws at a finger, which remains inert, sniffs once again, looks up, and walks calmly across the hand into the dark. Credits. The title, the studio, the stars flash on, then fade. Henry Mancini noise. And then my name glows on the darkened screen. It lingers there a while, etching the mind of every member of the audience. As well it should. This film required of me immense executive abilities. All those subordinates to keep in line, trained to alert me with their signal cries. Ready when you are, CB. That's what I like, that fine docility. As for the cast, if the truth be known, actors are idiots. Theirs is the glamour, of course. Their gorgeous looks, along with large unmerited salaries, must compensate them for their tiny minds. But in the end, after repeated takes, the prince, the cutting room floor, I am the one who sees that everything falls into place, the master plan. This film has a large cast, a huge cast, countless, you might almost say. And for them all, for every one of them, I have designed with supreme artfulness what could be called an inevitable plot.
Thank you.